I think it's a journey of self-exploration. Where do we find ourselves? And I mean, not just like talking heads, how did I get here? Not like that necessarily, but that's good too. Where do we find, as we live this life experience as humans in this form, where do we find the pieces of ourselves that are really relevant to being human? What does that mean? Creativity for me is the process by which I keep learning ways and getting mirrored back through many multiple angles what it means to be human.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
I'm here today with none other than Stephen Schubert. I am delighted, Stephen, to have you on the show. Welcome.
Matthew, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I love the gesture of offering to have me on. Thank you.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Stephen. Stephen, you are an artist, a polymath, a movie buff, a judo expert, a specialist in neurogastronomy. Most importantly, you're a creative. And reading your website, your basic principle is this Japanese term, which I'm going to murder right now, which is kohan ni shitigao.
Yeah, that's not a murder. It's a slight assault. Not a federal offense, but I guess they actually say it a little smoother and a little more. They release it. They let it free. Kohani shitigao.
Well, you understand. I have the audio version of Photoshop, so I can probably tweak it a little bit to make it sound incredibly authentic. Post production. But what does that mean for you? What those words? It's clearly a central premise. But what is the meaning of that?
I like contact points that allow you, that land in you authentically and propel you in different directions, or you find yourself organically reacting in different ways and send you off on a path that gives you some guidance. Because often everything is so, it's either over-organized, or when you're trying to be creative, you have to create a big open space. So kohani shitigao is a phrase from the Japanese culture, and it comes directly out of Japanese garden design.
Yeah.
And the phrase literally means follow the request. So when people are going to create a Japanese garden, the masters go to a site of land and they look at the land and they read the clues of the land. And that is where they get the design ideas. Yeah. And frequently, Japanese garden design is also about balance. It's about minimalism and refinement. But really what they're doing is they're recreating large scale aspects of our environment, of our landscape, and they bring them down into someone of kind of a manageable viewing fashion. And so, for example, they use something called forest perspective, where to make it look like there's a great distance, they'll take a rock and they'll place it maybe 13 feet away from a standing point or someplace where you might go and meditate. And then they'll put another rock that's smaller beyond that. So it'll appear that in your mind, maybe the rocks in real life would be the same size, but the furthest rock in the distance is smaller, conveying a sense of distance. And so anyway, kohani shitigao, follow the request, is something that I just took to. It just felt right to me. And of course, because I had an early background in judo, I was attracted to the Japanese culture for many reasons, and imbalance is not one of the least of it. And so I thought, my God, wouldn't it be great to live a life following the request, which really means you're listening. You're spending a lot of time listening to the world around you and basically responding from that place. So you don't have to figure everything out. In my life, when I sit and I listen, I'm able to stop the noise, and it gives me the next place that might, like an empty vessel, that can fill up. They have an interesting thing in Japanese garden design, and it's called a deer scare or a clacker. And if you ever saw the end of one of the Tarantino movies, Kill Bill, there's a big fight scene at the end, and there's a clacker that kind of sets the soundtrack to that scene. It's the snow is coming down. And so the clacker basically is a device made of bamboo, and it fills up with water. And when it gets to a certain point, it tips and empties the water out. And then when it falls back onto the stone, it makes a clacking sound.
Yes.
Originally, that was to help keep the deer away from eating all the foliage. But it became a garden feature. It's interesting. It's cool. It has this historical basis. And so in that way, the emptying and the filling and the emptying and the filling is how I look at that phrase in my life as well. So following the request means clearing out an empty space, listening, and then figuring out what to do from there.
Which is fantastic. But the tensions of trying to clear your mind and listen, because there are so many different things. As an artist, there are so many different tensions.
Absolutely.
In other words, how do you maintain that clarity of thought so that you are creating your art and you're not being pushed by commercial pressures or by the need for bread and butter art, or how do you avoid the tail wagging the dog?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, it is a struggle. Sometimes you feel like you're riding a wave and it's no issue. Other times, absolutely, all those things are affecting me. I seem to have antenna, and many artists in any creative field, you have a kind of antenna. You can pick up the ground vibrations before something's about to happen. You can actually contribute to it occurring and unfolding and evolving. I believe it isn't so clean and pure that we're not affected by the awareness of our life or what might sell. But in order to stay true to the pure place where you organically create from, I find that I just keep creating. I have some habits that I use that keep me in touch. I'm not a giant meditator. I love the concept, but I'm not as disciplined in that regard. But I found that I have other little components that I bring into my life. And in fact, I'll refer to the meditation, not in a formal way, but I built a Japanese garden on the property. And so there's a water wall, and I'm always sitting out there just quietly listening, watching, looking at the plantings and the trees and the rocks. So I believe that the way that I you have to keep reminding yourself. I think as life is changing, there's never a moment that ever stays the same. Before we began this conversation, I was different. During this conversation, talking to you right now, I'm going to be different at the end of the sentence that I'm speaking to you in incremental ways. Yep. Some seen, some not seen. So it's a constant process of filtering, and I believe practice. And
But awareness too, because the whole concept of being aware that you are in a process of change. Mm-hmm. And I just think that what you have is an incredibly difficult job, being an artist, trying to create or find a unique style that is instantly recognizable, but still at the same time, trying to maintain that purity of message and not being distracted. So does it get harder and harder each time, each day, to sort of dig deeper and deeper to avoid these external pressures?
It's like hooks and ladders. Every level of certain level of accomplishment now can beg a new question and a demand of yourself. Go deeper. And does it make it easier the more you accomplish? Sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes the struggle is unseen, that I had no idea it would be as difficult. And sometimes I'll say, wait a minute, I should have this by now, don't you think?
Yeah.
And so you're encountering a new basic primitive moment, and you're thinking, I should be at this point in my career or my life or my practice. I should be at a stage where this shouldn't really be an issue, but it's not true for me. I keep asking questions of myself. I have a group of artist friends, and I can say that many of them are replicating themselves over and over, or they found a niche, or they had success, they stuck with a niche, and now it's not successful. Some are still successful. Some are molding. We have a mutual friend, Jabu. He's someone who I'm getting to know, and when I watch how he involves himself in the creative process, he reminds me of me in some ways. He's constantly changing.
Yes.
He's trying new things. I mean, he has a painted zebra traveling around now, and that causes a reaction in people, and it's creating a dialogue. He does so many different styles, and I find that that's something that I've done too. I have many different styles. Now, I want to share a little more that you opened by throwing these accolades all over me, and it was lovely to hear these things, and you're going to be my new PR guy. Thank you. But the failures are so important. And there's a poet by the name of David White. And I don't know if you're familiar with David White.
I know the name. I'm not familiar with his poetry.
He's a poet, and one of the interesting earmarks, he's written some books. One is called Across the Unknown Seas, and that particular book was his approach to the corporate world. He wanted to bring humanity to the corporate structure so it wasn't just driven by bottom-line profits. And he's given numerous conversations, talks, on a very interesting feature called self-compassion. And this ties in with everything I'm about to share with you, because I believe if you can't fail, I mean, you can cover up your failures, you can try to present yourself as nothing but this constant continuation of successes. And for me, that's incredibly inauthentic.
Yep.
And I actually try to just really take myself to task to always check in and make sure that I'm balanced in my understanding of my creative process. And it includes great failures. So there are times, but I will say this, now I have more tools to handle the discomfort. I have more things I know how to do to address when I hit a new breach where I don't know what to do or I'm stuck.
And what do you think is the primary motivation behind art as an artist? You came into this, let me rephrase, you came into this at the age of 33. So that was your moment, your road to Damascus experience, your aha moment. So there is something that motivated you at that point and that is continuing to motivate you, what, 10 years later?
Many years later, thank you. You know what? I think it's a journey of self-exploration. Where do we find ourselves? And I mean, not just like talking heads, how did I get here? Not mm-hmm. like that necessarily, but that's good too. Where do we find, as we live this life experience as humans in this form, where do we find the pieces of ourselves that are really relevant to being human? What does that mean? Creativity for me is the process by which I keep learning ways and getting mirrored back through many multiple angles what it means to be human. Watching other people engage with each other in any form, listening to their creative efforts, their struggles, their failures. I keep finding myself. The reason we love movies, stories, good books, all these things where we all feel joined, it's because I think we find commonality when other people have discovered a voice that reflects our own moment.
And it takes me back to caveman art. Mm-hmm. If you think that the motivation was not commercial, for caveman art.
Really? Oh, yeah. No.
Unless there was some rudimentary type of art show.
If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, art shouldn't have showed up in the caveman world probably at all. If you think about the struggle for survival was so primal and continual. Anything could kill you. You had to kill your meal. You could probably be killed by someone who wanted your meal. I mean, it could be an animal or another, your friend. So I just think that there is this innate drive in human beings to find themselves, but also, and maybe it might not be that conscious, to keep exploring and expressing something. You know you're alive, and I don't think that's the conscious choice necessarily, but you know you're alive when you can see evidence of your presence. And that can come about through whatever swells up inside you that just needs expression.
And it's that drive for creativity. I mean, we've had this discussion about creativity before. Is the primary purpose creativity, do you think?
It's a great question. You know, the lecture that you and I had attended last week brought this into bear. And I almost raised my hand to give my definition, but I think it's many things. I don't know if I can whittle it right down. I think it's looking for ourselves, and I think there's an innate need to keep expressing something. And I was thinking about the definition of creativity last night.
Yeah.
And it hit me up a while. And I was wondering, you know, I don't feel like I'm the author of my artwork in a way. I never do. And I'm not also suggesting just that I'm this pure channel, but I know that those are the, you know, for example, if, you know, McCartney can write Here Comes the Sun going up the, was it McCartney or no, George Harrison, I think.
Yes.
In a chairlift, write a song in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
When you hear these stories of creativity and pops of people creating things that become, you know, iconic and so affecting, we're channeling things for sure. So in a way, we're participating and the creative process is being present for something that's outside of ourselves to come through us. So is it our consciousness that we think is the, the propellant for what gets created? Or are we really becoming vessels where we step out of our way and something is just coming and we just hear like a tuning fork inside of ourselves and we show up to respond like I did to the dream that resulted in me becoming an artist? It was one specific dream.
It's funny because I went to the Broad a few months back and there was this piece there called Tips for Artists Who Want to Sell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's a great piece by a guy called John Baldessari. Mm-hmm. I'll put a link to the picture, but it's basically a painting that says, if you want to sell, you know, a draw, I've got a print.
Booster, landscape, whatever, all this.
You know, it says, you know, it's like a poster and it says, generally speaking, paintings with light colors sell more quickly than paintings with dark colors. So it's this complete sort of anathema of what art is. But his point was, you can be creative even though other people are actually executing that creativity on your behalf. So you can create something, and it's a place to your point where you're not creating something yourself, you're channeling something from somewhere.
If you look at why certain people end up in museums, usually it's because what they've done may not be the first to chart new ground in the direction of an art movement, but they could be the one that got discovered doing it.
Yes.
And usually it marks a transition. So when you talk about expressionism or cubism or impressionism or realism or surrealism, there's a moment where someone's expression suddenly takes a turn. And now, so it's like fashion in a way that usually fashion explores all the things that haven't been done or were considered something not to do. And there's only so many iterations of something I'm imagining. And so, you know, 20 years later, some fashion comes back to skinny ties again, for example.
Yes.
Then there's a broad tie, and now everyone thinks that looks okay. And then a skinny tie looks kind of silly, you know. So I forgot where I was going with this.
We were just saying how art and how you're talking about people that are discovered and people that are in museums. It's not necessarily the fact that they were the best. It's just that at that moment, what they were doing kind of resonated with the zeitgeist of the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then it creates other people to get on board with that, and others can capitalize on that. I mean, you know, what's interesting to me, Jeff Koons' career is rather interesting. Yes. There was a time when I had a little production facility where I was making three-dimensional birchwood wall sculptures, and I had hired a guy who, he worked for me for about a year helping create these sculptures, and then he left and he went off to Brooklyn to work for Jeff Koons and part of his army of artists who execute his ideas. And it was fascinating to see, because I thought technically that this person who worked for me was a better artist than I was. He was school trained. I was not. I'm kind of like, I'm not a street artist, but I'm self-taught. And I just thought, wow, it's so interesting to see he's working for me. And yet I thought he was the better artist.
Yes.
But I had something that no one was doing at the time. And I still haven't seen anyone copying my three-dimensional birchwood wall sculptures, which I left. I left
yes.
about 15 years ago. I'm just doing abstracts mostly now, and some other things we might get into later. But I just find that very interesting what goes into how someone becomes marketable, commercial. A lot of it is belief in yourself, and also the purity of your direction. I had another occasion where I had someone from the CalArts working for me, and he couldn't work for me very long because he said the competition to keep creating art and enter into these projects was so demanding.
Yeah.
He didn't really have the spare time he thought he would to make some extra money on the side. And the rigorous, the regime, he said to me, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm not getting my own voice.
Yeah.
Because I'm executing all the requirements that people want, but there doesn't seem to be that much room for me to actually break out and find that uniqueness that I will possess. So, that I have. And so it's an interesting question how that plays into this.
So would you say that art is a form of unrequited love?
Oh, that's a beauty. Yes. And it is your lover and it is your lover and as well. And it's the lover who does give back. I mean, I think it's all of it.
Yes.
Now, what's fascinating is I don't think you can pin anything down. You have a moment where you go, yeah, this is true right now. And then all of a sudden the next moment passes and then either you've shifted or you don't agree that it's true for you anymore, or it doesn't buzz you the same way anymore.
It's funny because there are so many parallels between what you're doing, the creative world that you're in, who was it said, the reason that you create art is because you cannot not create art. It's like this sort of this calling that you are unable not to do it. And there are so many parallels with entrepreneurs or people that see business. Because I think that if you start businesses, that's a form of art to a certain
Absolutely.
Extent.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. When I, you know, we're talking about art right now, and there's an aspect to it that's still a little abstract. But the reality is when the rubber hits the road, that's when whatever it is I've created, I now have to take that out into the world.
Yes.
And do I want to make a living at my profession? Absolutely. And which I do. And that piece is essential. It has to be commercially viable on some level. It may be backwards. It may be that I created something and the people are responding, they're buying it and they're rewarding me, and that's great. Or it could be, well, I'm going to paint more lighter paintings because Baldessari said they sell better. You know, I mean, that's not going on in my mind actively, but I'm sure that everything that goes in, I have found artists who actually handcuff themselves because they are obsessed with the idea of purity.
Yes.
And I'm faithful to that idea. I absolutely believe in it, but I believe it should not be an impediment to my creativity or what I explore. It should actually be, I shouldn't even really be paying it that much attention to it, except after the fact to feel like when I engage my brush and my whatever I'm creating, I want that to come out of a very pure place.
Yeah, and you're right, but again, from a business perspective, so you have an entrepreneur who has a vision that tries to execute on that vision and maybe doesn't get the immediate response, that instant gratification that he requires. And somebody might say, you know, I think your business idea is great, but you need to do it a bit like this. You need to pivot. You need to change your... It feels almost like someone is saying, you know, what you've created is rubbish. And look, let me tell you how it's... As a business person, it feels like that when I've got this idea, you know, how dare you challenge it? But you have to learn that, you know, you might have this vision, but there are other people out there that really you need to listen to. Is that...
I read Fast Company and Inc. magazine.
Yes.
The stories about how people create what they do on the corporate level and how startups grow and become great successes and reach people. I mean, I'm fascinated by how these things, you know, happen. There's a book called Contagious, you know, how does a viral moment, what goes into, what makes a viral moment? So, but first of all, I want to just acknowledge something that you said earlier. When he or she does create a startup, for example, that's not artwork, but it's a service or a product, I believe it's extraordinarily creative. I believe that what goes into play to make that happen and the fact that these things actually... they start as an idea and it may be apparently clear that it's a need fulfilling something, or it may not be, but people stick with it and find unusual and creative ways to actually execute their idea and bring it into being. It blows my mind. And I'm always entranced with it. And I feel totally connected to people when they do that as an artist, because I understand the artistry I believe it takes to do that. But here's something else that's kind of funny. When I read all these magazines, Inc. magazine, you know, there was a time when I was, when I had six employees, I was trying to be a perfect employer.
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember reading was full disclosure to your employees about what you were making and the money coming in and all this. And and I took that idea, I ran with it, and it backfired on me.
I was going to say, I think that has now subsequently been updated, that chapter.
Yes, but when you watch, you know, Marcus Lemonis on The Prophet, he'll get together with a group of people and he'll say, I just made a deal with your boss for $500,000. We're going to be putting this to pay off the debt and this for the growth and blah, blah, blah. And he lets people in that way. But
yes,
but it doesn't go further to my knowledge. But I found it interesting because when I read the stories of all the successes, which are mostly what they outline in those magazines, I know there's a million people trying to execute those ideas, following those steps, and they'll never have that level of success that went into some of those companies. And I realize there's an undefinable, the X factor, why something hit at the right time. It could be a t-shirt company. Yes. Right. It could be. It could be. I forget what the name that went out of Boston. Life is good.
Yeah, yeah.
But it seems like every year there's another T-shirt company coming out, and wouldn't you think after 50 years we've had enough T-shirts?
Yes. Because,
like, the fabric doesn't really change that much unless it's like dry wick. Yes. But the slogans are what are becoming the commercial, you know, the balance. I was reading today in the paper that Nike is going to be shuttering some stores and they're going more traditional. They're not thinking on such a wide variety of styles. They want to trim their line down and go with classic designs more. And I'm just thinking that, yeah, all this adjusting needs to constantly take place. So you have to always be adjusting and adapting. And I got fooled for a while trying to emulate the Inc. magazine success stories with certain moves that I was reading about. And they didn't work for me.
Is that because you're always behind the curve? Is that because if you're chasing, it's like we were talking earlier about the designs. If you're trying to create something for what you perceive the demand will be, you're always out of step. And the things that are successful are because there is some undefinable magic that the principal or the artist or the CEO or the founder has.
I think timing is a big, big piece of it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So you said behind the curve. So that would be a linear, you know, reference. Yeah, I believe so. I believe that's a big piece of it. But then you get lots of copycats. That's how things happen. You have a pioneer.
Yeah.
And then you always get the flood of people and the people who, you know, look at Hollywood movie making, right? The great thrust of it has shifted so much from, it's shifted to, we want a big blockbuster. And there's this regurgitation of all of the superhero movies. And I'm not dissing the fact that I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, and I'm dying to. And I think
I haven't seen it either.
Out there, and it's making a statement and helping women in that regard. That's not really what I'm saying. But just when you realize that a decision, many decisions are being made for safe reasons.
Okay, so my theory is that, I'm not sure if it's just US culture, but certainly culture generally, maybe it is US culture, doesn't view intellectuals and thinking as good, honest, hard work.
We're obsessed with success, and intellectuals don't necessarily lead to success, although the tech world has shown us that the nerd intellectual has provided the new buzz of being desirable. So therefore, that world of intellectualism has contributed and is embraced, but that's because it's tech related. And that affects everybody, although there's a limitation there. But if you talk about the cultural contributions, I was always first attracted to foreign movies over American movies. I was a bit of a loner as a kid, so I found solace in foreign film. I'd go into the theater by myself or with a friend, and I'd see the movies up there, and they were the tone of them and the personalization, the way they would, you know, zoom in on a cricket, you know, crawling across the grass blade. I found myself there. I found like, oh, that's how what I relate to. I didn't relate to the, well, let me step back. I believe America's obsessed with success.
Yeah.
And that has its price. And so certain things will be pushed to the side to serve that master.
It's almost like a discrimination against the right brain, as it were, you know. That.
Yes, yes. If the right brain can serve the greater bottom line, I think then it has a place at the table for people, for some people. And that's a huge part of how I feel things get decided and executed.
But I think with all the people that I've been speaking to, there is this sort of movement, there is this momentum building, which is a move away from the exchange economy. You know, in other words, I do this for you, what's in it for me, to more of a giving economy. And if you're an artist and your finger is on the pulse. Are you seeing that? Are you finding that there's a what people are buying or what people want is changing, and it's not like fashion. It's actually, is it developing? Is it?
So here's some cool things. Here's some cool things about what I observe in the marketplace as I sell my artwork. I can look at my demographic. So who's buying my art? What age ranges are they? Are they couples? Are they singles? What's their sexual preference? I mean, I look at all these ingredients, and I see, and now I get to tell you that in my abstract work right now, I'm obsessed with transformation and transition. I love the moment where something is one thing and then suddenly it's becoming something else. That fascinates me. And so many of my pieces of artwork are explorations in abstracted form of those transitions. So people are coming up to me and they're stopping and staring in front of the piece.
Yes.
The greatest compliment doesn't have to be that I'll take it, but it can simply be wow, or thanking me, or shaking my hand. They were touched or moved in a way, and they're responding to the fact that if I'm representing the movement of transition and change, that's all inclusive. There's no one's excluded in that process. It's universal to all of us. And I'm watching people of all ages. I had a man 3 weeks ago. He's 79 years old, and he just bought one of my pieces called Turn the Page. Yes. He's putting it in a think tank in Florida. Wow. And usually when you see a person who's over 70, they're usually not in the collecting stage anymore. I mean, of course, there's thoughts in that world, and they can move that way any way they want, and they do that. But most people, that's not most of the people. And so it's wonderful to see that happen. So I get all ages, and they are all responding to the idea of transition and change. I have a piece called Pluripotent, which is it looks like a mishmash of colors, but really it's interestingly orchestrated, and it's about stem cells and how now they're finding that you might not need a stem cell from a liver to make another liver.
Yes.
So those cells that show the possibility of being applicable to creating something beyond the scope of what they're identified as, pluripotent. They're potent in plural ways.
In ways, yeah.
Enabling themselves to become a participant in like making you a new liver. I mean, that's amazing.
But when you see this, when you see people being affected physically or right in front of your eyes, as it were, do you get that feeling, I want more of this, I want to scale this? How do I get this message out to more people?
Absolutely.
Get sort of burning feeling? How do I?
Yes. You know what? If you were to keep speaking, you could become a Southern preacher and raise the level and escalate to the point where I'd say, yes, brother, that's it. It's exactly right. I do feel that way a lot. I do feel a lot of frustration as well. I feel like sometimes I get assaulted with ideas and I'll never have enough time to execute them all. Or the logistics of managing what I'm actually doing takes away from time to want to explore new territory. And this actually... It was actually something you said earlier. I don't know if I want to, I didn't want to leave it behind, but I do also want to talk about this other art project that I think will scale.
Well, that's what I was sort of alluding to was,
my Brush with Nature project.
Yeah. So this wanting to, and this ties in with what we said at the very beginning about the Japanese, which is now an unpronounceable phrase, because I can't remember how to pronounce it. But that wanting to connect people to, wanting them to take a moment to actually be there where they are in scale. So the project that you're working on now, how does that achieve that?
Okay. I believe, I mean, I'm just finding myself that I came up with this idea that's just ridiculously simple and it's terribly obvious. It's basically a giant paintbrush, and it's a paintbrush in the fashion of like an edging brush. So it has a broad, it's broad, it's like 6 inches high. And I thought of taking that and chroming it in a beautiful reflective surface so the whole environment is caught in it, your own image can be caught in it, and it would, similar in the way that the cloud sculpture functions in Chicago, that magnificent piece. And it's sitting at an angle as though someone with an invisible hand is dragging it across the tarmac, except coming off the bristles as though it were dipped in some magical fertilized greenery. is a swatch of grass leading to a green belt. And then a progression of everything and anything green, live, living green things, will look like they've emanated from the bristles of this magic brush. And it's called Brush with Nature, which has numerous meanings. But the idea is just simple and literal, too. Brush with nature. I mean, use things green. In our building, that's changing now. The building codes there's more green than ever before. We recognize the importance of not destroying the planet. So that's showing up with advanced new design. And the brush with nature, if you take a break from your office building, you go down into a plaza and you're sitting there and there's a giant chromed brush with grass coming off it, swirling off to another area, sitting with trees and other green areas. It'll also make you think, in a kind of a surreal way, wow, interesting. Look, that brush created this green belt. So it's also a subtle reminder that not only is the environment changing, but we are living in an environment where when you're sitting in the absence of green, you may not know that.
Yes.
I mean, you get lucky enough to put a little plant in your cubicle or something like that. But if you're not thinking about it, it's just a gentle reminder to come outside, to be, if you have to be in the middle of concrete, remember what nature provides. That's the source for everything.
Okay, so now you have this thing which runs the risk of being an all-consuming project, as it were. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, a whole new set of tensions, and very similar to what you get in the business world, for example, where, you know, I've got this idea for this new service or this new product, which I think could completely dominate the sector. And do you get that, the twin angels of sort of fear and courage battling with each other? So do you find yourself holding back slightly? Is this too big a project? Am I biting off more than I can chew? Or do you feel, I'm just going to make this happen. I don't know how, I don't know when, but it's I'm going to see this thing come to life.
That's the angel I'm connected to right now. I've already experienced a few obstacles. Now, this project doesn't exist, but I built a tabletop model. I've hired an assistant to help me do research to find out who the point people are to talk to bring this project to bear in certain settings. I mean, there is a program called 1% for the Arts, which designates 1% of the budget of a new construction project, commercial construction project, should be designated for either an art piece or some landscaping. I mean, it doesn't have to be art necessarily. This kind of combines both. But that process often entails a competition, and I'm not interested in that. I've done a public art project before for a local city, and there was a competition, and I won the competition, and I got the commission. But frequently the requirements for these RFQs, requests for qualifications, require that you've done three or four projects, you know, minimum $250,000, $500,000. So it eliminates so many people who have vision but don't have that experience.
Which is entirely counterproductive and illogical.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's similar to what you might encounter on the board of people who you have to present ideas to. You'll get always some incredible open-minded people, and then you'll get some very anal retentive, bureaucratic nightmare cobweb makers and spinners, and they just love to implant obstacles, speed bumps, you know? So I don't want to deal with any of that because it's not interesting to me and it seems unnecessary. So I don't feel the need that I have to participate that way. So listen, if I could just walk up to Larry Ellison and he likes my idea. I mean, if a security guard didn't push me away.
Yeah.
And Larry, you know, had a moment. I mean, someone like that could simply green light this idea and say, you know, the concept's really good. I like that. I'd like to bring that around. So here's something interesting that happened. There's about 102 projects that are taking place, construction projects in downtown LA right now. So I thought I'd start in my own backyard.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing the research to find out who to talk to. Three of the projects are $1 billion-plus projects. Yeah. With some Chinese companies. And I thought, I would love this to be in downtown LA. It would be perfect to be in an urban setting to have this brush and then a whole green area. Oh. And then I thought that could also be a pipeline to China, where they certainly, and I'm thinking that because they're one of the greatest offenders in terms of air pollution.
Yeah.
They also know that. And the other day I was online and I came across some buildings that were constructed. The first, I think, was in Milan, Italy. But the Chinese are now going to be finishing some projects where towers are going to be made, and they're green towers.
Absolutely, yes.
Filled with beautiful trees and greenery. And in fact, this hints back to an artist I got turned on to about, I guess, 10 years ago, Hundertwasser.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of Hundertwasser. No. He's an artist who many years, he's no longer alive, but many years ago, he designed buildings that were integrated into the environment in a way where he would put trees on top of the building. He would put trees on balconies. There would be a big scarf of green land looking like a giant mound of earth. And then suddenly the building would emerge out the side of it. And it yes. was all about combining
integration, yeah.
nature with the urban setting. And in the studies they're doing on the oxygen conversion of yes. green, the green effect, it's remarkable. So I thought not only would this be a striking brush with nature, it's a reminder again, but it also will actually change the way everyone gets to breathe.
But I think it comes back to the point where because it doesn't have definable commercial benefits,
right?
It's almost like you can, the natural thing is to discount it. But what everyone is missing is that, and I think this is where the human improvement movement is becoming so much more relevant, is that there are certain currently indefinable benefits that are far more important.
Absolutely.
The way that people feel that injection of energy as they walk towards that building, that feeling of connectivity, the feeling that they actually want to go to work because they get this energy from seeing what is effectively what you've created, which is this conduit between nature and nurture and the workplace. So
that's beautifully said, actually. Thank you, Matt.
Trademark. Yes.
Got it. That's beautiful. And you said something earlier too about society and exchange. And, you know, I was familiar with potlatch societies. I read about that many, many years ago, and how if you had a fish and I had corn, we'd get together, we could make a meal, and you could feed each other's village, you know, with a Absolutely. Nice corn chowder with fish in it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so one of the other things that I'm aware of is now we're reading about the millennial mentality, yes. how they're not concerned on materialism. The same way, they want experiences.
Absolutely.
And so they're shifting the culture's direction.
Yeah.
And they're steering us to embrace more of what you're describing as this place where we have better experiences that enhance more people, that give experiences, more healthy experiences to people.
Well, it's more about the long-term benefits of emotional intelligence.
It's inclusion.
Exactly.
As opposed to exclusion, as opposed to certain people who, you know, are very driven by the idea that we need to make, I don't want to go running into phrases now that become political, but the idea of sharing is something I think that's what we're experiencing more of that now.
Exactly. This whole movement towards abundance rather than exclusion.
Share exactly. Exactly.
And I think that's what we're seeing is that there are all people that are leading this. And I think that is something that is so exciting because that is a real evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not discarding commercialism and capitalism, but we're evolving. And maybe it's the millennial generation that's going to do that. But I think from your perspective, I can feel the excitement of having the ability to really create something that will be there for a very, very long time. And it's not just your legacy, but it's this, it could be that moment that the switch that's flicked that changes people's approach.
It's true, Matthew, isn't it? We never know what it is that's going to be the switch inside ourselves. We never know what it's going to be. We have an idea, we can prepare ourselves, but it could be the most innocuous little thing. And I don't think in terms of legacy, but I do think in terms of change. And if this, for example, I have other ideas as well, but if this brush with nature, I'm going to just keep going until I die to execute it. I don't think it'll take that long. I think I'll get to enjoy it before the end of my life, but and hopefully within a year or two.
What do they say? It's very difficult to stop a man that's never going to give up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I don't see the dark angel around this at all. I just see nothing. But this is what I learned about myself. If I can envision it, I can create it.
But I can feel the energy. I can feel this, you know, it is all about possibility, and it's all about creativity. And I think it's all about being pure. And the thing that that moves the needle, if you want to use that horrible expression, or flicks the switch, is momentum behind purity. It's the fact that you have that pure thought. You're not tainted by commercialism. You're dancing to your own tune. You're paddling your own canoe. But there's so much momentum that you created that it pierces through the resistance. And I hopefully you'll invite me to the opening day.
Absolutely. And I wanted to say something else, because you were speaking about the palpable passion or enthusiasm you detect as I'm sharing my love of this idea. And I just want to say that the entire process of being with you in this cast is also really interesting to me, because you're creating a place where you're allowing my enthusiasm to really reveal itself in another way. And it's a component of your questions and your enthusiasm as well. And I can tell the passion that's seething out of you. It's also palpable. And I wanted to acknowledge that, because I want to say that that doesn't go unnoticed. And that's something that feeds me. Wonderful. As well. So it's like picking up the clues. It's more Kohani Shitagao, following the quest of the...
There it goes again. I'm going to pronounce it. I want to get a what do they call those things? A Rosetta Stone disc, and just practice that phrase over and over. Stephen, I can't thank you enough. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. So how do people get in touch with you? How do they find out more about what you're doing?
And my website will be the first place to go. I'm not even opposed to putting my phone number out there, but SchubertModern.com is my website. And Schubert is spelled like the musician Franz Schubert. So SchubertModern.com will get you in touch with me. You can just email me through the website as well. And I think my phone number is on there.
Wonderful. Well, I'll put all those links on the show notes of the podcast. But again, Stephen, thank you so much.
Matthew, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
I'll see you soon. All right. Brilliant. Bye-bye.
Bye.